Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, I interview Michael Friedman, who's the writer of The Fortress of Solitude, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, and Love's Labor's Lost. Peter and Michael join in to review The Tempest in Central Park, Dr. Faust is at Classic Stage Company, Office Politics, the Atlantic Theatre Company's production of Gars at the Taj, and the Masterwork Theatre Company's A Midsummer Night's Dream. That plus a DC and New England Theatre Report. Please stay tuned. Taking no more.
Turn to cry.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 21st, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us today, we have a very special guest. And I think it's a first time for us coming to us from Central Park. We have Michael Friedman is joining us by phone. Michael is the writer of musicals such as Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, Love's Labor's Lost. We have that new recording that was just released called The Fortress of Solitude. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh, such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. What are you doing out in Central Park? Are you enjoying this beautiful weather?
I'm working. I'm doing the music for Shakespeare in the Park. Michael Greif is doing a production of The Tempest, starring, my goodness, my brain. Can I start that one over?
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. Michael Greif is doing a production of The Tempest, starring Sam Waterston. So I'm doing the music for it. It's my fifth Shakespeare in the Park, which is kind of wonderful.
Wow. That is awesome.
Yeah.
How did you
it's
get
very magical
out here. Fifth one.
My very first job in New York City many years ago, you can all do the math if you want to in the privacy of your homes, was I did a production of Cymbeline that Andre Serban directed in 1998.
Huh.
So that it's always felt sort of like home to me at the Delacorte.
Wow, that is very cool. You have a very wide-ranging career. According to IBDB, you have 3 Broadway credits. One is as a dramaturg for Raisin in the Sun. You did music for 33 Variations and, of course, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, which everybody knows. But the first two, I was looking this up and I was like...
Yes, I was the first Broadway revival of Raising the Sun, the one that...
2004.
With Sean Combs and Audrey McDonald and Felicia Rashad. That one, I was the dramaturg for. It was a very funny and unexpected thing. But I was an American history major in college and actually knew a lot about that uh-huh. time. And I knew one of the producers who had been talking to Sean Combs and the director, Kenny Leon, and they'd kind of said, we need somebody to sort of help us work as a sort of dramaturg on the show. And he was like, why don't we bring in Michael? So somehow I ended up being brought in, and it was actually a really magical experience. And also that play, which I had known sort of, to get to live inside that play, which was just... I think Lorraine Hansberry is just sort of unbelievable. So that was very lucky. I felt very lucky to get to be involved in that show.
And, you know, you seem to have a really strong connection back to the public theater. You know?
I do. I was trying to count, and I actually lost count because I've done a bunch of shows with the public with the Civilians theater company I've been involved with now since 2001. And then some shows of my own, and then I've done music for a bunch of shows. So it sort of adds up. I think it's something like 15, 16 shows with the public that I've done. So that's really nice.
Wow.
To have that as a kind of artistic home, I feel incredibly lucky over many administrations, because 1988, it was actually back in George Wolfe's period, and now Oscar Eustis has been obviously incredibly supportive and wonderful to work with over the years.
You know, how did you, what was your first gig at the Public?
It was, in fact, Cymbeline in the Park in 1998. And then I waited a few years, and then I got to do in 2001, I did the Seagull in the park that everyone involved was famous, if you remember that time.
It was like
Meryl Streep and Kevin Kline and Natalie Portman and Philip Seymour Hoffman, rest in peace. And it was quite an amazing summer.
So Fortress of Solitude, production that was down at the Public as well, and also out in Dallas. There was a co-production, right?
Yeah, we premiered at the Dallas Theater Center and then went to the Public afterwards, which was actually incredibly happy. Kevin Moriarty, who the wonderful man who runs the Dallas Theater Center, and Oscar Eustace go way back, and Oscar runs the Public. And so it was a very happy and very fulfilling for Ethan Moses, who wrote the book, and Daniel Aukin, who directed it, and myself. Just a really happy collaboration.
So tell us about what was the genesis of Fortress of Solitude?
Of course. And anyone who writes musicals, no one else believes us, but those of us who do write musicals, a musical goes quickly if it is produced in like 4 years. Or 5 years, like that's a quick process.
Yeah.
So in 2000, Jonathan Leetham, in the early years of the 21st century, wrote this amazing novel called The Fortress of Solitude, which is a very autobiographical novel. It's set on Dean Street in Brooklyn, on the block where Jonathan actually grew up. And so many elements in the book are autobiographical. That said, it's a work of fiction. It has fantasy elements, all sorts of things. Daniel Aukin, who I've known for years and is an incredible director, read it and called me and just said, we'd sort of been looking for a project together, and he said, I think there's something in this. And I read it, and I fell really passionately in love with the novel. I think it spoke to me about my own childhood in a lot of ways. But I called Daniel back, and I was like, well, this novel is too great for us to touch. And then 24 hours later, I called him back and said, we have to make this musical. I have to do it or I will die. So it was a quick turnaround. And what that was I loved the book, but I couldn't see. For a second, I sort of just saw that I loved it and I didn't want to do anything to it. And then the next day, I kind of hadn't slept, and I'd realized, you know, on a new musical, finding the way in is the hard part. And what I'd realized is, I'm looking at it again, the novel is built on music. It sort of takes place in the last 25 years of the 20th century, and it is partly just sort of it's one of the characters is a singer, and so much of the way Jonathan writes deals with the way pop culture sort of infiltrates our lives. And so that felt like I'd never seen a musical that kind of dealt with that question of what is all this pop culture that we have in our heads, and how does it help us understand who we are, and what is its emotional resonance for us? So that was kind of my way in. And then once we started, we got Ethan Moses involved, and a lot of actors who stuck with us along a very kind of marvelous development process, where we really got to write the show we wanted to write, and these amazing actors. And then finally, the Public and Dallas Theater Center got involved, and we were incredibly lucky to have all those people along the way.
Well, that's, were you instrumental at throwing it in front of somebody at the Public, or did it get in through another way?
Oscar Eustace had come, I guess, maybe at my invitation, probably. So I think I was, this was a nice project in that a lot of relationships that had existed got to be strengthened by it. Edamar and Daniel both knew Oscar already, and Edamar had done a play with Kevin Moriarty before. Our amazing music director, Kim Grigsby, who's one of the legends of the American theater. She had a long relationship with Kevin and with the Public, but also with Tom Hulse and Ira Pittleman, who came on as producers on the show and were unbelievable to work with. They, of course, did Spring Awakening and American Idiot. So it was a really happy, almost everyone involved became like kind of a very dear friend, and that is not always true in theater. So it was a special process, and I think the show itself was to me. I certainly don't feel like I've written a show that is more special and dear to me. It's certainly not a score.
I want to share with you that we had Kurt Deutsch on to talk about the last 5 years movie a couple of months ago. Last 5 years, I guess February 14th it was released. So before like in January, we talked to him. And he couldn't stop talking about Fortress of Solitude. how much he loved it.
It's a change. Anyone who knows my work at all, it's kind of a change of pace for me. It's a very it's a show without a lot of snark, and a very it's a big show, and I kind of I think sometimes I've written a lot of shows with, you know, like Little Funny Tunes, so which I love doing. I love writing Little Funny Tunes, but this is just a change of pace for me. So I think it surprised a lot of people in that way.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because listening to The Fortress of Solitude, it's so much different than Bloody Bloody and Love is Labor Lost and all the other stuff that that you do with the civilians as well. So, you know, did you have to go and research this, or is this the type of music that you grew up with and you just hadn't explored that?
You know, it's funny. Every show I do, I think one of the first things I do is I do a huge amount of research. Bloody Bloody, I listen to emo rock for like 6 months straight. And then I sort of put that away and try to figure out what the show wants. And in Bloody Bloody, it's a very short score, Bloody Bloody. It's like half an hour of music. But, you know, it wanted something more explosive and something where the humor was kind of in your face, but also where even the, you know, there's a few of those songs that are pretty serious, but where that was, you know, a rock energy. And in this case, it was what the show demanded was both to relook at those 25 years of American music and try to figure out what put them together. And in some ways, what I really wanted to do was interweave styles and emotions and the ways people felt, both had it be very character driven and also driven by this ineffable thing, which is the block of Dean Street on which so much of the novel and musical take place. And for me, I think that just created a very different sound. So I sort of hate writers who are like, I just write what the characters or the situation demands. But I guess that is in fact how I write shows. I'm sort of like, well, this show needs to sound like this, and this character would sing like this. So in the case of Fortress, it's a big canvas with a lot of very emotionally resonant and really upsetting themes that it deals with.
Let's talk for a second about Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson and how that you caught lightning in a bottle there and down at the Public, and it was so exciting to have that quick turnaround and bring it to Broadway. What did you expect that at the time?
Alex and I wrote that show. We wrote that show, Timbers, and I wrote it. We were introduced by Kurt Deutsch in 2005, so 10 years ago. We met. I knew his company, Le Frères Corbusier, and he, I think, knew the civilians. And they do a lot of work with history, and civilians do a lot of work with kind of real, sometimes even historical topics, but real life and verbatim stuff. And so we met, and within about 45 minutes, I think we'd been like, well, what about like an emo rock musical about Andrew Jackson? So it's definitely, I was like, this is the fastest conceived Broadway show in history. Like 45 minutes after its creators met, they had a fairly specific idea of this show. But certainly what I mean by that is we developed that show at Williamstown with their non-equity company. A very wonderful company, but of non-professional actors, or not yet professional actors, but some of whom ended up being in the show and on Broadway. And then we did it at, it first was premiered in LA at Center Theater Group, Michael Ritchie Theater out there. And then Oscar did it twice at the Public, once in the smallest theater and then at the Newman's. By the time we got to Broadway, the whole thing had been like this strange, magical, magic carpet ride. So getting to Broadway was... And getting to Broadway, as I think Alex would say, doing the show that I think we always meant to do with its sort of weirdness and craziness and everything that sort of was very personal to Alex and me intact was kind of the opposite of what you hear about going to Broadway, which is like, you know, when the show opened on Broadway, it was one of the most magical nights I've ever had, where I was like, oh my gosh, that's our show. So that felt really great. And God, I wish the run had been longer, but
sure.
You know,
yeah.
We got 100 performances at the Jacobs, one of the most lovely theaters there is, with an amazing cast and a gorgeous design team. We got to get that great cast album. And the show's been produced all over the place, and that's been also really, really rewarding. I had not thought about how rewarding it would be to know that your show's being done all over the country.
So
I think Broadway did make that possible.
How did you find Benjamin Walker?
when we were doing Bloody Bloody at Williamstown with their non-equity company, mm-hmm. Ben was in a production I also did that summer of Romeo and Juliet, playing Mercutio at Williamstown, in a kind of indelible, amazing performance of Mercutio. And so I met him through that production, and then he saw Bloody Bloody in that version, and then that all ended up, so he had sort of been interested in doing it, and I was like, I think this is our guy. And so it all kind of worked out in a very marvelous and simple way.
So the folks over at Maxima, which is another theatrical podcast, were singing the praises of the Civilians this week, and that you are also very busy in the Civilians as well, as well as doing your stuff at the park and all the other stuff.
I think I've done 10 shows with the Civilians since 2001. Every time, the shows are always involve an investigative experience, like to go into a community or look at a subject and do an intense amount of research or interviews or both. And those processes, you know, I was a history major in college, and processes like that, I found some of the most rewarding times of my career. Our most recent show we did together was the show Pretty Filthy, which was about the adult film industry, the porn industry. Mm-hmm. So Bess Wall, this amazing playwright, and Steve Costin, the director who runs the Civilians, and I spent quite a lot of time going to porn sets and interviewing porn stars and hanging out in the San Fernando Valley at Starbucks or sushi restaurants, and saw many things we'd never seen before and probably will never see again, and ended up writing a show about that. So it's kind of, when else am I going to get the chance to live within the porn industry? So that's part of why I do love working with Civilians so much.
Well, that is just amazing. I mean, the work that the Civilians do, it is sort of, to me, it's journalistic and theatrical and a biography of sorts. And so it must present a lot of artistic canvases and challenges for writers like you.
And the challenges are what's fun, because one thing I've gotten really interested in is the way real people talk and how to turn that into song, how to, you know, create lyrics that are trying to capture the way actual speech works, you know, all with all the likes and and, you know, and all those things, because actually in song that can be kind of marvelous. So that's been, I think I've learned a lot about songwriting and even musical theater construction from working with the Civilians on shows that I think a lot of people would think of as sort of outside the main thrust of musical theater.
Mm-hmm. So you have this going on at the park right now. What else do you have? What do you got in the hopper coming up?
Yeah, I have a show, a musical I wrote with Daniel Goldstein called Unknown Soldier.
Oh, yeah.
That premieres in July, or right at the beginning of August, I guess, at Williamstown, at the Williamstown mm-hmm. Theater
that's
Festival.
Right.
That's directed by Tripp Cullman. And that's going to be, we have an amazing cast that I can't tell anybody yet because we haven't quite announced it, but we have a really beautiful cast, and that's going to be, it's a chamber musical and a very, very romantic. So maybe I've moved away from my snarky period into my like romantic period. Who knows? maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that bodes well for my life. And then I'm working on, this crazy show called American Pop, which was a commission from Oregon Shakespeare Festival as part of this huge commissioning thing they have going, where they're commissioning playwrights, like 50 playwrights, to write plays about American history. And mine is, I'm taking on kind of American popular music before World War I, and trying to, which is a very complicated time. For many reasons, so has been really intense and actually has led me to learn a lot about my own family that I didn't know before. Some of it interesting and some of it horrifying,
sure.
But that's good too.
You know, Ben Affleck learned that that Channel 13 series that his family owned slaves.
And, I had heard that. Well, this was one I learned that some members of my family fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War that I hadn't known. And the craziest was I learned my father's family had a shoe factory. A shoe company. And if you go online, and I won't tell you the name because I don't want everybody to go online, but you can find pictures of the child laborers who worked at my family's shoe factory. little children, and you're like, oh no, this is horrible.
So, yeah, we can't be responsible for the sins of our forefathers.
I think that's true, but the show is about, and I think it's one thing I've gotten really interested in, the show, the show is interested in, but what are we responsible for, especially if we sing songs that come from that or that are about that? Do we need to know what, do you need to know what a song's origins are? Are you responsible, if not for everything your ancestors did, certainly for continuing the legacy of some of the stuff they did? And I think those are real questions that we all grapple with.
That is,
and that I think
question.
We don't think of as having much to do with music, but in this case, it's been amazing how much, the first hit popular song in America was Oh Susanna, a song in which the N-word is used a few times. And that's like, oh, that's surprising to me, because that's a song we teach kids in nursery school. So it's things like that where, so should we write the word out of the lyrics? Should we explain this to children? Should we ban the song? And I actually don't, the answer is really tricky. And I think a politically, popular music is at the center of how we deal with politics in a lot of ways. So.
Wow, that's great. I'm looking forward to that. So I'll let you get back to your work in Central Park right now.
Thank you.
Let people know that they can pick up your latest recording, which is The Fortress of Solitude, at Chickaboom, and I'll have links to that in the show notes. And if
awesome.
You want to catch up with Michael Friedman, you're going to have to go to his shows and hunt him down, because he's nowhere on social media. You've removed yourself from the social media foray.
I love social media. Social media is wonderful, but I have gone since October social media free. So I'm off that grid. But I'm very findable, and I hope people enjoy the Fortress of Solitude album. It was I'm really, really proud of it. So I hope people will listen to it.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. We will speak soon, okay?
Thank you so much.
On and 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 on. But the song makes a space. So try to hold on, to hold on, to hold on before it slips away.
All right, into our reviews. Michael and Peter got a chance to see Tempest at Shakespeare in the Park. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Sure. First off, it's always a pleasure to be in Central Park when it's a nice night, and the night I went was a nice night, and this is an experience everybody should have, not just New Yorkers, even if waiting in line is a difficult experience, but who knows, maybe you'll meet somebody nice there, or maybe you'll meet somebody nice sitting next to them once you're inside, but you may be very glad you're there just to see the show. Well, I will say that one of my big bugaboos is that Shakespeare is always done on a unit set, and it's not a terribly good-looking set. It's mostly just scaffolding, and there are floorboards that are very right for the first scene because we're on a ship, but after that, we're on a magical island, and I would have liked to have seen something that resembled a magical island. And places are demarcated here by neon. That's where you find out where you are, and that doesn't tell you very much. But yes, of course, we know where we are, basically, but still, I'm reminded of the days when they spent a little more money on sets out there and made them a little more attractive. So I would have liked to have seen a magical island be a magical, mystical miracle. So, all right, but the play's the thing, right? And there's a disappointment there, too, I think, in the sense that we expect a good deal from Prospero, given that Sam Waterston is playing it. And I have to admit that I didn't think he was very good at all. Yeah, he had this very funny walk, for one thing, and he seemed more like a mad scientist to me than and one has to concede that, if you were exiled to an island and spent there 12 years, you might go crazy, too. So Michael Greif might have really wanted that, and or Waterston talked him into it, that type of thing. But he didn't have the type of power or authority that I usually see in Prospero. And maybe, again, it was the feeling that it's time to see a guy who's really in tough shape. Okay, fine. I can go along with that. I can understand the decision, but he comes across as pretty weak to me. But there's this woman named Francesca Carpanini, who plays Miranda, who's really quite good indeed. She starts off as being daddy's little girl, which is what you want her to be at the beginning, you know, right? An immature sound, an innocent sound. And of course, once she sees Ferdinand, boy, I mean, it's definitely love at first sight, which makes sense for her. For him, you know, I've often wondered, you know, he's a sailor. Does he have a girl in every port? Is this just the latest conquest that he's going to have? Something that's occurred to me as time has gone on. He has not played as any big deal either. His name is Rodney Richardson, and it seems to me a very perfunctory performance. But again, it's possible this was what Michael Greif was going for, because at the end of the play, of course, Miranda comes out and sees all the other sailors, and after she supposedly has been in love with Ferdinand, suddenly she sees all these other sailors, and oh wonder how many godly creatures are there here, how beauteous mankind is. So I don't know what's going to happen. I would like to see The Tempest 2, the sequel, where we find out if it worked out between Ferdinand and Miranda now that she's seen all those other guys. But, of course, Shakespeare was winding down, so and that wand was being broken and buried, so that was that. Ariel and Caliban are quite good, though. Chris Perfetti, Ariel, Louis Cancelmi. And what I liked about him, he walked like one of those satyrs, you know, those guys with the furry legs and the horns on their heads. I liked that very, very much. And I liked his halting delivery as if he was searching for many of his words. So I thought that was good, too. So may not be the quintessential production of The Tempest, but still A Night in Central Park is definitely worth having. And I beg of you, if you've not had this experience, to make sure you have it. So I hope you like Sam Waterston and the set more than I did.
Michael, what did you think?
I agree with everything Peter said. The night I went, which was Monday the 15th, it was like a miracle that we got to see the show because it had been rainy all day. I almost didn't bother to head to the park, but, you know, you never know. And then, you know, we got there and it was still very wet in the air, but it didn't rain a drop. And we saw the whole show. It got a little cool, but I was prepared for that. So that was really that made it all the more enjoyable because I just did not think it was going to happen. I think that most of the issues here can be pinned on Michael Greif, whose work I have said before I generally don't enjoy. I think that Sam Waterston was basically miscast. It's not that his acting is not good, but it's just he's really not – doesn't have the right kind of authority that Prospero, I think, should have. I preferred Patrick Stewart. I thought that Sam's portrayal was – he seemed kind of frail and a little shaky and also quite old, which it's just not the way I picture it, and I guess maybe not necessarily the way Peter pictures it either. Obviously, there's room for interpretation, but that's what I thought. The set, I also agree in general. I did think that the quality of the projection of the roiling sea that was there so often, I thought it looked beautiful, but it would have been nice to have more variation. And I will say that it does. The set does lead to literally probably the last 3 minutes of the show, a quite an extraordinary coup de théâtre where the park is revealed, and that really, I thought that was wonderfully effective. I agree about Francesca Carpanini. There was one actor, I have got to say, there was one actor in playing the King of Milan, I won't name him, who had such a bad speech impediment that I could not understand the reason for this person being on stage. I don't see who's being done a favor in a case like that. And the person I was with commented on it too. I just don't really get that. So I'm not sure what was going on in Michael Greif's mind with that. Cotter Smith was excellent as Antonio. I haven't seen him in a while, but he was great. And Jesse Tyler Ferguson did his usual very reliable clown stuff as Trinculo. Danny Mastrogiorgio was Stefano, whether you're being Italian or British, I guess. I thought both in this production, both Ariel and Caliban were wearing sort of variations on leather harnesses, I suppose they were supposed to look like, to point up the fact that they are, you know, being controlled by Prospero. And I think that's fine as far as it went. But I really didn't, again, I did not like Chris Perfetti's characterization. He was so kind of creepy to me. He almost seemed like a Renfield. And I never.
That's a very good point. Yeah, yeah. I like that. That's a very good idea.
Yeah, very, very, very odd readings and kind of slithery. I never, ever pictured Ariel that way. On the other hand, I think Lewis Cancelmi was brilliant. I've always loved him. I don't think he works as often as he should, although he probably does a lot of stuff I don't know about. Aside from the gait that Peter mentioned, he had just a very light, I would say almost like an island accent, a Jamaican accent, mm-hmm. that made him set him apart from the rest of them. I mean, they keep referring to how, you know, odd and misshapen, you know, a monster he is. Meanwhile, this guy has got one of the greatest bodies you've ever seen in your life. So he had to do it by other means. So he did it with his halting delivery and the little bit of an accent and the odd gait. And I just think he's extraordinary. So I hope to see much, much, much more from him. And then finally, I would just say that I thought the music by Michael Friedman was absolutely beautiful. I actually hadn't checked the program beforehand. And halfway through, I turned to my friend and said, "Who wrote the music? It's gorgeous." And then I checked at intermission, and I was glad and surprised to see it was Michael. So that was wonderful.
All right. So The Tempest is running at the Delacorte Theater through July 5th. So get down there. There's many ways to get tickets these days, not just sitting online. They have, I guess, four different ways to get tickets. And I'll link to the production's website where they have ticket outlined how to get them on our show page. So go to BroadwayRadio.com and you can get it there. Peter and I got a chance to see Dr. Faustus at Classic Stage Company. Mm. So, Peter, why don't you give me a synopsis of what you thought?
What does it mean that whenever I hear this title, I'm always putting it to the tune of Oklahoma? I don't know what that means. But
wow.
Dr. Faustus. I mean, what can I tell you? I mean, that's what I do. So
there's medicine you can take.
Oh, I hope so. The sooner the better, really.
Please don't take that medicine, Pete.
Please take your medicine, dear Pete. Anyway, Dr. Faustus, same problem as Tempest, the wrong yeah. leading man. Chris Noth is terribly, terribly ineffective and perfunctory and doesn't have a theater voice. He's softer than everybody else, and he seems to have learned the show, but that's about it, actually. So for the first half hour, well, maybe not that long, but anyway, for the first substantial number of minutes, I thought this is going to be god-awful beyond any human being's comprehension. It's funny, there's a line in the play that's very famous, of course, "Misery loves company." And I thought, boy, you know, all of us who are in Chris Nost's company here are pretty miserable. So, but, you know, you know, whatever, que sera, sera, you know, which also comes from this play, whatever will be, you know, it's impossible not to think of Alfred Hitchcock or Doris Day when you, but, those are the two big lines in this play. So, but then Zach Grenier comes in playing Lucifer's messenger, Mephistopheles, and he really gives the show a hot foot, which is really great. You know that, and it's funny because it's really not, you know, a fire and brimstone performance. It's very understated. I mean, it's like the guy's on the job again. You know, it's another day's work for him. But there's something so. Enervating still about the fact that you're dealing with an emissary of the devil, and so even though it's a little underplayed, that makes it funny, and suddenly you're interested in a way that you weren't before. Lucifer does come in, actually. He comes in a little later and wearing a white suit and red socks, the way Mr. Applegate used to wear, the way Van Johnson used to wear. I'm not implying that Van Johnson, you know, is the devil. But anyway, you know, who knows, you know. But you know, then it comes a bit to life, you know, when that happens. The seven deadly sins come in. I will say that something happens that suckers the audience. I don't like when that happens, when they lead you to believe one thing is happening and something else is happening entirely. I don't want to be too specific on that in case you're going. But anyway, I think you may very well feel the same way, because when you say, oh, that's marvelous, and then you realize, oh, that was very carefully planned. I'll use the analogy of Tommy Steele in Half a Sixpence, who gave a marvelous performance in that show. And at one point, all of us who went to see the show were calling up our friends and saying to them, oh, wow. And, you know, at the performance I went to, you know, one of the dancers lost his hat, and Tommy Steele just picked it up and frisbeed over it to him. You know, and so I said, well, that happened to my performance, too. You know, and it was a carefully staged accident. Well, there's something like that that happens in this Dr. Faustus that's a little phony in that way, too. So anyway, you do get to see a lot of Helen of Troy in the show, I'll tell you that. You know, I mean, it's not just it's not just the face that launched a thousand ships, you know what I mean? So after a shaky start, it gets better. And I was able to stay with it. My mind didn't wander at all, but I really thought for the first 20 or so minutes that this was going to be a total disaster. Not that Christoph ever gets any better, really. He doesn't. But what's going on around him is entertaining enough to keep your mind on the ball.
Well, you know, so many of the even the off-Broadway companies, they do rely on star casting. Sometimes they seem to have their own little stables of people they use over and over again. But CSC, so often, I have to say, it seems like miscasting. And I just wish they would be more careful.
Well, Peter, I agree with you 100% to everything that you said. I said, oh, yes, you know, Chris Noth, it's not a good role for him. And the show was 20 to 30 minutes. Exactly what I was saying was like, for the first 20 to 30 minutes, I'm like, are we coming back for the second half? It was really tough to get through that first part of the show. And then Zach Grenier came on stage. And
so you had the same experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's a master. I mean,
you know, a couple of years ago, he was in some play at the Atlantic. I don't remember what it was called, but he had to play somebody with who had like had a stroke and his mouth was extended and all this kind of stuff. And I had interviewed him some years ago when he was doing a play at Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. And he was such a nice guy. And I felt so bad when I saw him playing this character. I assumed that he had a stroke.
Oh, my God.
It was that convincing, you know, and I felt so bad for him. And then later on, during the curtain call, suddenly that grimace had disappeared and he was smiling and all, and I was so relieved. But he's that good an actor, you know, and so he really is worth seeing. So, yes, at least that. But fans of Mr. Big will find this very small.
Although fans of The Good Wife, where Zach Grenier plays a major role in that, will really enjoy it as well. And he was nominated for 33 Variations, a Tony Award nomination back in 2009. So I am hard pressed to recommend Dr. Faustus, but if you are a fan of Zach Grenier or would really like to see a wonderful performance, I recommend getting down to go to the CSC to see it. Michael, you went down to Washington, D.C. and saw a bunch of shows. So why don't you tell us what you saw and what you thought?
Yeah, I'll be brief, but I did want to talk about all three of them. One of them was Tartuffe, which at the Shakespeare Theater, which I shouldn't actually review because they were still in previews. But I did want to say, what an extraordinary play. If anyone near you is doing Tartuffe, I mean, it's not exactly as popular as Romeo and Juliet, go. It's about religious hypocrisy. It's about people being enthralled to quote unquote religious leaders, despite all evidence to the fact that they are frauds. It's about self-delusion, the degree to, that people can delude themselves in order to follow these people because they're so lost in their own lives. I mean, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, it could be fundamentalist Christians, it could be Scientology, it could be any one of a number of things. And it's I don't know if it's comforting or makes you feel worse to know that this has been going on, you know, at least since Molière's day. One would think that we would have improved and gotten a little smarter over the centuries and gotten out of it, but I don't think so. We still see evidence of it today. So really, see Tartuffe if you can. It's an incredibly brilliant, timeless work by Molière. I also saw the first production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead that I have ever seen. And I'm glad to say it was an excellent one at the Folger Theater. Guildenstern was Adam Wesley Brown, and Rosencrantz was Ramel Witherspoon, although people who are familiar with the play will know that for a while you're really not sure which one is which, because there's a lot of that. Oh no, I'm Guildenstern, he's Rosencrantz. It's one of Tom Stoppard's earlier works, and I prefer his earlier works. I just think they're sharper.
Easy to understand. They are
sharper. Yes, they're easier to understand. They're less weighty, less pretentious. Mm. I would say. And this one is a really wonderful play about the meaning of existence. It's kind of like it has elements of Waiting for Godot, almost like why are we here and what is our purpose, and but all in a very theatrical context, because there's even a group of players that shows up. It's basically what happens off stage in Hamlet, and then we see some of actually what happens on stage in Hamlet too, and it's quite brilliant. These two actors especially were superb, Ramel Witherspoon and Adam Wesley Brown, who, as I mentioned, a few days later after I got back from D.C., there he was on the Tony Awards in that little sequence where people were talking about teachers who made a great deal of have been so beneficial to their lives, and there he was. So that was a nice little surprise to see him there. And the Folger Theater is gorgeous. I had never been there. It's very old style, somewhat modified, what you might think of as the old Globe. Although, of course, the people, I mean, everyone's sitting, nobody's standing, they're on our groundlings. A lot of wood paneling, and it's definitely worth a trip. I guess it's somewhat off the beaten path in terms of the major theaters we think of in DC, but I'm really glad I got there. Oh, and they have the lobby has exhibits in it, and currently they have one of the first folios on exhibit. So so that's always a thrill to see that and think that, oh my God, this is actually it. This is kind of practically where it started. Mm-hmm. And then I saw Cabaret at the Signature Theater, and it was so interesting. Primarily in the way that the director, Matthew Gardner, what he kept the same and what he changed in the general sort of new concept that was established quite some years ago now by Sam Mendes and then, I guess, abetted by Rob Marshall. It's basically the same. It's very, very over the top, vulgar things that happen constantly in the Cabaret numbers, which, as I've gone on record many times saying, I really don't like that. And I have to say, unfortunately, that Wesley Taylor, who played the MC, apparently some people are going nuts for him, but that's just because I guess they respond to that. He's extremely, extremely sexual. even more so than Alan Cumming, if you can imagine that. He's very much in your face. But also he has like a sneer on his face throughout the entire show. It's really more of a even more of an S&M situation. It doesn't look like he's enjoying himself in his sexiness. It's just very, very forbidding and off-putting to me. And on top of that, his accent was so thick that I really didn't understand a lot of what he was saying, which is unfortunate. So I think that was a miscalculation. But Fräulein Schneider, Naomi Jacobson, Herr Schultz, Rick Fuchsow, they were two of the best people I have ever seen in those roles, those wonderful roles. And it was worth it if only for the trip to see them, because I've seen some less than satisfying portrayals of those parts. They were so invested in it. The audience was with their story so much. And I'm really glad that I saw that. And then finally, just to end on a point that I made with when we were talking about the last Broadway revival, when it opened with Michelle Williams, how her performance was very controversial, I think received largely negative response, and I loved it. And as I said to Peter, I really do think that Sally Bowles is – there were so many ways to portray that part that leads to the fact that there's so much controversy in terms of people's response to any particular performance. And one thing in particular, it's so fascinating. It could get into a really long discussion, which we won't do, but how self-aware is Sally? That's the first question. And then the second question is, what does the actress do or not do to let us know how self-aware she is? And there are so many levels to that, so many little things you could do with your eyes, your voice, that I think that leads to so many varied opinions on performances. But I thought Barrett Wilbert Weed was phenomenal, and I'm glad that I got to see it for her as well. She's a very tall woman. She came across as very strong in some ways, but of course Sally's a mess. So it was a fascinating, very complex performance, and I loved it.
All right, so I will have links to all three of those productions, the Signature Theater down in DC, their site. On the Cabaret page that I've linked to has a lot of great photographs and information. It's a very cool website, so check it out. Peter got up to Boston a couple weeks ago and saw a few productions. So, Peter, why don't you give us your Boston report?
Well, it's not just Boston, because on the way I stopped at Goodspeed to see Guys and Dolls And I'll also add that in Stoneham, Massachusetts, there's a tiny little theater called the Stoneham Theater, and they did How to Succeed. So we're talking about two Frank Lesser shows that were rescued when times were tough, because book writers did have terrible problems with them. Mm. The first Cy Feuer, every time I saw him, he was one of the original producers of Guys and Dolls, used to point that finger in my face and said, "Joe Swirling never wrote a single word of Guys and Dolls, even though he got top billing." Well, a similar but scenario happened 11 years later when How to Succeed was happening. Actually, How to Succeed was based on a play that had been adapted from Shepard Mead's mock how-to manual. And again, the same thing happened. They, in the sense that they didn't like the script and they wanted to make it into a musical, and they called Abe Burrows, who 11 years earlier had rescued them with Guys and Dolls, and he rescued again. So there are similarities there. But these were two big Broadway musicals of their time. In fact, they both played the same theater, the 46th Street, now the Richard Rogers, in their original production. So they are big shows. But the wonderful thing that we can say here is that they reduce well. They really do. And that was the charm of seeing them, that some shows just don't, but these, because the characters are so interesting, that we follow the characters, we don't worry about the fact that there isn't that, for example, in How to Succeed, a desk may be in front of an elevator bank, you know, with the lights down low so we don't see the elevator bank, that type of thing. So we're not as concerned because we do get interested in the fates of these people. And so both very nice productions. And, of course, one of the reasons I went to see Guys and Dolls was the fact that Nancy Anderson was playing Miss Adelaide. She's one of my favorite current crop of stars that we have. I'm always interested in seeing what she does, and she certainly delivered on Miss Adelaide, especially in what I consider to be the most important part of the characterization. And that occurs, you're going to think I'm going to say Adelaide's Lament. Yes, but the reprise. Late in the show, when it looks like Nathan isn't going to marry her for the umpteenth time, and Skye Masterson even tells her off a little, saying, you know, you women, all you want to do is change your men. Why don't you accept them the way they are? Which is a very good point, of course. But still, she then comes out with a little reprise of Adelaide's Lament, and it has to really show us that she really isn't just this bimbo who appears at the hotbox. She really is a full-dimensional character, and this is where that comes out. And Nancy Anderson made us really care about her. And for those of us who are not that thrilled with the idea of getting married, you know, you suddenly see it from her vantage point, and it's very moving. So she really delivered there. So a nice production indeed. So that was fine. How to Succeed too, a very nice production up in Boston, and it got me to go back to the actual manual that Shepard Mead wrote in 1952, which was a bestseller, by the way, and. And so the story is that Jack Weinstock and Willie Gilbert, Jack Weinstock, by the way, was a neurosurgeon. And Willie Gilbert, who was a writer, was his patient. Huh. And they both started talking about, gee, isn't this book wonderful? I made me laugh, you know. And so they optioned it and they wrote the play. And for 5 years, they couldn't get it on. And finally, they brought it to Fuhr and Martin, well, their agent did, and Fuhr and Martin said, this would make a great musical. And that would have to happen because, I mean, Fuhr and Martin had only done musicals up until that point, six of them, five of which were hits. So that was kind of interesting. Well, I've always loved How to Succeed. It was the first smash hit that was happening when I got interested in seeing shows, so it's always I feel like I'm seeing that hit that was happening just as I was getting interested. There's a gentleman by the name of Tyler Bradley Indyck, I-N-D-Y-C-K, who followed in the great tradition of the adorable Finch. He's got to be adorable because you really have to like this guy because, after all, it wouldn't take much for us to turn against him. Though, again, Abe Burrows, I assume, cleverly wrote him so that he never quite lies. You know, when he goes to the personnel office, I just bumped into the president. He did. He bumped into him. Kaboom, you know, and but if the other guy takes that as, oh, gee, he really knows the president, you know, I mean, that's his problem. So he never quite does any lying. When he sets up his boss, when he sends in Hedy LaRue, the va-va-va-voom secretary, he has to very much, you know that it's going to happen, that Mr. Gatch is going to fall for her and he's going to get in trouble because this is Big Lee's secretary. But again, you know, if Mr. Gatch played it by the rules and was a nice guy and just said thank you, Miss LaRue, and let her go, then that would he'd still have his job. He wouldn't be in Venezuela. So Finch is very cleverly written, and this Tyler Bradley Indyck really did a very, very fine job in making him quasi innocent and yet shrewd as well, and that has to happen if How to Succeed is going to work, and it really did very much there. But really, what a great show. I mean, and I urge people to find the original manual and see what was added and what wasn't. And frankly, if you don't want to do that, next Friday at my column on www, as in Worldwide Rickets, by the way, mtishows.com. I'm going into the differences between the manual and the actual musical and what they took and what they left out and what they had to really create. And you really have to give perhaps Weinstock, perhaps Gilbert, undoubtedly Abe Burrows, credit for really making a musical out of a very convoluted, strange book that was never meant to be anything like it. It's one thing to adapt a novel, a play, a movie. Okay, you've got a structure there, but this was not that type of thing at all. And many characters were invented, many situations were borrowed from the book, especially the famous Grand Old Ivy scene. That was actually culled from three completely different scenes in the manual, and Weinstock, Gilbert, or probably Burroughs, was able to put them all together and make that wonderful scene as we have them. So Friday the 26th, do call up mtishows.com and see what I have to say about the differences between the musical and the original book. But a very nice little production. I'd also be remiss to not mention that I went to the North Shore Music Theater saw Dreamgirls there in a terrific production. I've always had problems with Dreamgirls, I have to admit it, because I have issues with Effie White, that character, who is not a good team player. You know, so she should be very grateful that she's part of a very successful group, even if she has to sing backup. So I like the show immeasurably, but I'm not quite thrilled with that character who says, "What about me? What about what about what I want and what I need and all that?" So, I this is a show that very much does very well in the round, because this is one of our few summer stock theaters from way back when that still exists in the round, in what was a tent but now has been enclosed and air conditioned and all that, with real theater seats as opposed to canvas seats that we used to have to sit on. So, and what makes it well in the round, because there are three dreams, and each of them can face a part of the audience when they're singing, you know, so you never feel shunted. The big thing about in the round is you always see somebody's back. There are 50% of the time you're not having anybody towards you, but that's what's good about the dreams. You always get at least one dream. So I thought that was a very good show for a show in the round, and I like that very much. So that's that. But before I move on, I do want to take some moment to talk about what Michael had said about Tartuffe, and also what he mentioned about the teacher who got the Tony Award. And that's Corey Mitchell. And he teaches at a school in North Carolina. And I imagine that one of the reasons he got the Tony Award as best teacher is because he's the one who actually taught Eva Nobilzada, who is playing Miss Saigon's Kim in London. You know, so he was her teacher. And this is the girl who finished second in the Jimmy Awards, but was noticed by Tara Rubin and was taken to London and got the part and has been doing it for more than a year. And I saw her recently and she was terrific in it. So I have a feeling that was a component, you know, because he really did well by Eva Nobilzada. The other thing, a funny story, I think. We'll let you be the judge of it. But when Michael was talking about religious hypocrisy, so John Gielgud's Ages of Man, Shakespeare Soliloquies, was just released on re-released at Masterworks Broadway, where I do a column every Tuesday.
I just got it in the mail. I haven't had a chance to listen to it.
Oh, it's really quite good. Well, yeah. Anyway, it's not just Shakespearean soliloquies. He adds a few comments here and there. So anyway, here's what I wrote for my column for last Tuesday. It's still up. For those who may doubt that Shakespeare is relevant in this 21st century, just go to track 6. Gielgud starts by saying, in Measure for Measure, Shakespeare has drawn a narrow, self-righteous judge, Angelo, who finds himself caught against his own will in the very sin he most condemns. So, all right, so I'm writing about that, and I thought, you know, this would be a good opportunity to mention Larry Craig, Mark Foley, Anthony Weiner, and Mark Sanford, you know.
Et cetera, indeed.
But I thought I'd be fair and mention two Republicans and two Democrats, you know, so that would be nice to do. Well, then I thought, you know, I bet my editor is going to get back to me and say, we try to avoid being political here. I want you to drop that last line. And when she wrote back to me, she mentioned put a dash in between here and there, blah, blah, blah. And I love the last line. So it worked exactly different from what I expected. So, yes, Tartuffe will always be relevant, I'm sorry to say. And so will Measure for Measure. What can we do?
Yeah.
All right. So you made it back from your Northeast trip.
I did. And live to tell the tale.
Live to tell the tale.
You know, just,
you know, I'm so excited that you that North Shore Music Theater is still a functioning theater, because there was some time there that
it was closed.
It looked like it got CPR, and it seems like it's doing well now. So that's great.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Michael got a chance to see Office Politics at the June Havoc Theater. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I saw this play called Office Politics by Marcy Lovitch. And, yeah, it was at the June Havoc. And it's amazing. Sometimes there's like – it seems like there's something in the zeitgeist. It's set in the ad sales office of Healthy Woman magazine, New York City. And then about a week later, I saw Gloria – at the Vineyard, which is set in a magazine office, both of them to a certain extent are about office politics. But the weird thing about Peter, did you say you have seen neither? Is that right?
Right.
Well, maybe we'll hold off on talking about Gloria to another another time. But Office Politics, the strange thing about it to me was that it was primarily focused on a racially insensitive remark that is made by one of the white males in the office and the fallout of that. And so that was by far the primary focus of the play. The first act is set in the office of the magazine. And then act two is set at an inn and spa upstate New York, where they all go for, they used to be called encounter sessions, like to sort of communicate with each other and try to smooth over and come to some, you know, understanding of each other and walk in the other person's shoes and understand how a remark can be insensitive and blah, blah, blah. So all of that was kind of interesting. Yet another play about race and racial relations. But the incredibly odd thing about this play is that in the meantime, there were all these sexual liaisons going on among various people in the audience, in the office. And I thought they're like not even mentioning that. It's almost as if it was a given. Now, I don't know if it was supposed to be ironic. I don't think so. It's like they were making this huge, tremendous deal about somebody saying something insensitive racially, and then not making a huge deal about all of these relationships within an office that can wreak havoc with office politics and the way people relate to each other and morale and all of that. So I don't understand what the playwright was getting trying to get at there. And I'd actually like to maybe have a discussion with her at some point. I just did not get it.
All right. So that is playing. Gloria is playing through July 3rd. Office Politics, as far as I can tell, is closed, isn't it?
I think it was a short run, yeah.
Yeah, I think Office Politics just closed perhaps yesterday, is the 20th.
But Gloria, I will look, if hopefully Peter will get to see it. If not, I'll maybe discuss it next week, because it's really quite something.
All right. Peter got a chance to see Guards at the Taj at the Atlantic Theater Company. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
I thought it was very good. Very good indeed. I urge people to go. Two character play. Two guards who are making sure that nobody sees this building that's being built, the Taj Mahal. And I'm telling you, this emperor is really intent on keeping this place a secret. There's an enormous wall that's built around it, and not even these guards are allowed to look and see how it looks, how it's coming along. Well, of course, good orchestration of character here by Ravi Joseph, who's the playwright. One of the guards is curious, one is not. One doesn't dare to be curious because, after all, this is his job, and he knows what he has to do, and the emperor is the boss, and that's all there is to it. While the other guy, what's the harm if I look and see what's going on? So really, this is a good metaphor for liberal and conservative politics, and we do get a lot of feeling about how conservatives don't quite make things happen, while liberals have the spark of creation in them. There is a big price to pay, and I'm telling you, after seeing this play, I had to go home and Google and see if there was any truth to what was going on here. Because what this deals with, and it is apparently a myth, I will say that again, it is apparently a myth, but it was said at the time, the rumor went around, that after the Taj was built, that the emperor decided that every man who worked on it would have his hands cut off because that way those men could never make anything as beautiful again. So this is not something the playwright invented. This is something that's been said for centuries. And the play does deal with that factor. And I'm not going to say how, but I am going to say that if you think you're going to see a play where two guys stand in front of a wall all night, and it looks like it's going to be, and you say to yourself, these guys ain't going to lose any weight on this play because it's not, they very well might as time goes on, because this issue does become a big issue. 85 minutes, that's all. It flew by for me, and the two actors are sensational in it, so... a unique play. We don't get anything dealing with this subject terribly often. And more to the point, the idea of what is life like when you just live it by the book? And what is life like when you take chances in your life? And the consequences of chances, are they worth taking? Do you take those risks? That's what this play is about, and that's what makes it really quite wonderful.
Yeah, the fellow drama desk member who sat next to me at Gloria last night said she absolutely loved it, and she so much so. I mean, she made me really want to see it. Mm-hmm. So, and now you have done the same.
Good.
Well, it's been extended through July 12th, 2015. So get down to the Atlantic Theater Company and go see it. All right. And the last thing for today is that Peter got a chance to see A Midsummer Night's Dream at Eric Krebs's new company, Masterworks Theater Company, on 47th Street. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Well, Eric really wants kids to start going to the theaters, so he decided to do productions of plays that should be seen. And his first one was The Glass Menagerie, which I have to admit I missed. The second one is Midsummer Night's Dream, done very much abridged, 90 minutes and out, and that's really quite good, so nobody has to worry about attention span, no intermission, anything like that. And very nicely done, Nick Surley from the Skivvies is wearing a little more... if you don't know the Skivvies, it's an act where two people perform in their underwear. And Nick wears a little bit more here and has also composed the music for it. He's a very talented guy. And he plays Puck here and does a wonderful job. It's wonderfully condensed. It's so nice to see Jan Leslie Harding, an actress from my hometown of Arlington, Massachusetts, up there playing one of the rude mechanicals, so there's a lot of gender bending here. I mean, there are definitely people who are playing male roles who are women, but so nice to hear the giggles of children at Shakespeare. And so Eric Krebs is doing the job in making sure that this is a fine production, but also his aim to get little kids in certainly succeeded, and more to the point, made them really see that Shakespeare was not to be feared, but was to be enjoyed. And really, when you think of it, Midsummer Night's Dream really is an excellent introduction to Shakespeare, because it has a lot of low comedy in it. It is just lofty speeches. You can follow what's going on. And frankly, teens in the audience very much can relate to the fact that you fall in love with somebody and your father doesn't like the guy, you know, that type of thing. You know, I mean, that happens to a lot of us, you know. And though I've often wondered why Aegeus leaves his daughter and her bow there and storms off stage, I would think he'd want to keep his eye on her every second. But that's something that I should take up with Shakespeare and not with Eric Krebs or this production. So keep an eye on this. He hasn't announced any future productions, but I'm hoping that that Masterworks does well for him and that he will continue doing this because it really is quite a public service.
Peter, I don't think you were with us, but Nick Searley and Lauren Molina from the Skivvies joined us.
About a year or so.
He's terrific, and I'm so glad to hear. I've heard nothing but good things about this production. Glass and Menagerie was not that great overall, but it did have two wonderful performances. Sandra Santiago was really wonderful as Amanda. It sounds like maybe they've that was their very first one, Glass Menagerie.
Sure.
So maybe now they're starting to find their footing.
Mm-hmm. So.
All right. So let's wrap it up for today. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio. There will be a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you don't have to. You can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream This Week on Broadway directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, or for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well, as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, I gave a lot of titles of songs and saying they once belonged to a musical, and they were all cut, and some of the titles were Harlequinade, Out of Town, Collaboration. Well, the answer is Candor and Imp's Curtains. If you know Curtains now, it starts with a musical of Robin Hood that is being performed at the Colonial Theater in Boston until the leading lady is murdered. Okay, well, originally they were going to do it as a Commedia dell'arte show that was being done at the Colonial Theater in Boston. And I do think it was a wise idea to drop that idea because Commedia dell'arte is something that people don't really understand today, not the general audience. You're much better off with a parody of Robin Hood, you know, set in the Old West. In fact, ironically enough, in 1972, a Commedia dell'arte musical called Comedy, that was its name, played the Colonial Theater in Boston, never got out of there. It closed there. That was the end of it. George S. Irving was in it, but nobody could do anything with it, and that was the end of it. So anyway, that's the answer to that question, which leads to my next question, because this information comes from a demo that was made by Candor and Ebb and Peter Stone, to a little bit. He's on it, too. And this was made in the 80s. In fact, if you know Curtains and you know the song Show People, there's the lyric, "The audience paid plenty." To get in. Well, the original lyric was the audience paid 50 because back in the 80s, that's how much it costs. So, of course, you need many more syllables today to fill in the audience paid. So that's why it's now plenty. But anyway, in that same lyric, there's a reference to they jeer Sherlock Holmes and cheer Mac the Knife. Well, when this show was being written in the 80s, they didn't use Mac the Knife. They use somebody else there. And if you look at the name Mac the Knife, you will get a hint as to what three-syllable name, a very famous name in musical theater history, a very famous character in musical theater history, that they used instead. Now, I will tell you that they had a completely different rhyme. So you're not looking for a rhyme for knife. That's not the point at all. But you are looking for a three-syllable name that would be indicating that people today don't cheer heroes, they cheer anti-heroes. So they jeer Sherlock Holmes, cheer Sherlock Holmes and jeer ba-ba-ba, who is the person that was originally mentioned there. And I will say that the name Mac the Knife is a hint as to who it was. So that's the question for this week.
All right, so if you have the answer to that, send us an email at trivia@broadwayradio.com. When you send the answer, remind us what question you're answering, because people are catching up on podcasts and they're sending us answers from weeks and months ago, and I'm not sure what they're talking about because I have a very short attention span. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
to chase a song and run away. Or maybe your father was wrong to stay, to sit upstairs and paint a space every day, to save a dream that's bound to fail, like a ring that lets you out of jail, to sing along that stubborn song that goes on and on. Right in the face, the world that you remember is a made-up place, and you will never get some closure from Holland and Dozier. Sam Cooke and Michael Jackson won't give no satisfaction, 'cause whatever song you sing, it doesn't change a thing, and won't bring back what's gone without a trace. But you have to know, there was a place called Dean Street, and my mother had a dream, and there was a boy called Mingus Rood, and he could paint so beautiful. So I and two boys were friends, and they could fly, they could fucking fly. That's how I see it.
And the sun.